Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present former CIA analyst Mel Goodman, who assesses the significance of the CIA's admission that it spied on Senate staffers investigating the agency's role in Bush-era torture of U.S.-held detainees. Josh Rubner of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, who talks about his group's effort to hold the U.S. government accountable for its supply of weapons to Israel in the current assault on Gaza amid widely reported human rights violations. And Deborah Deno, professor of law at Fordham University School of Law, who discusses the history and ethics of lethal injections used to carry out U.S. death sentences after the most recent botched execution in Arizona. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After mourning the deaths of world-renowned AIDS researchers and activists killed in the downing of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 over eastern Ukraine, the International AIDS Conference in Melbourne, Australia, convened despite the loss. The gathering's broad agenda included adopting a goal to end the AIDS epidemic around the world by 2030 and reports on progress on new AIDS treatment strategies using anti-cancer protocols and expanded access to tuberculosis treatment. The nature of the AIDS crisis has changed dramatically since the disease first emerged in the early 1980s. Since 2005, global AIDS fatalities have fallen by nearly a million deaths annually, and new treatments have been effective in blocking transmission of HIV/AIDS. Former U.S. President Bill Clinton expressed his optimism, telling the AIDS conference he saw a steady march in the global campaign to stamp out AIDS. Still, Clinton sees many challenges ahead, including an estimated 20,000 children who will be infected with HIV every month, mostly in Africa and Eastern Europe, regions where there is little access to effective AIDS treatment. Fear of AIDS and social taboos against people with AIDS have blocked important public health initiatives. A report by the Open Society Foundations found that local police prevented IV drug abusers from obtaining clean needles in Russia, Burma, and Vietnam, while over 70 nations continue to criminalize same-sex relationships, thereby making treatment for AIDS a criminal offense. Over the past 8 years, and with U.S. support, there were plans to build a billion-dollar power grid from new hydropower plants in Central Asia to alleviate the shortages suffered by Afghanistan and Pakistan. The premise was that in the summer months, melting snow fills reservoirs beyond capacity in Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. But winters create shortages in these areas due to a crumbling Soviet-era water and electricity infrastructure and results in generated electricity that is not easily shared. As the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan winds down, the dream of a regional energy hub has stalled, in part due to China grabbing up large amounts of energy contracts and Central Asian nations fighting over future hydropower projects. The World Bank has pledged $530 million in grants and loans for the power project, and the United States $15 million, with hopes to lessen Russia's influence. Although Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan are in favor of building the new dams, it is not without controversy, and downstream Uzbekistan fears losing water supplies. Uzbek President Islam Karimov has even warned that construction of the dams could provoke a war. After a packed July 4th weekend, Trump Plaza Hotel and Casino in Atlantic City sent out 1,000 layoff notices with a threat to close down in the fall. It's a sign of the times for Atlantic City's sinking casino economy, as three casinos have announced plans to close after Labor Day, leaving 7,000 casino workers on the unemployment line. Observers of the casino industry say Atlantic City's troubles have been driven by falling revenues linked to the luring of customers to new casinos in neighboring states, including Pennsylvania, New York, and Maryland. They also point to the failure to make Atlantic City an all-season entertainment destination like Las Vegas. By diversifying its attractions, Las Vegas is now much less dependent on gambling revenue to stay profitable than it was 10 years ago. In These Times magazine reports that Atlantic City unions with thousands of members in the gaming industry intend to ask New Jersey elected officials to become more engaged in preventing massive job losses. One demand is to have the state lean on casino owners like Donald Trump, who was reported to have had a buyer for his Atlantic City property last year but failed to finalize the sale. The unions say the state has every right to force these owners to sell to somebody who can keep the city's casinos open. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
In an admission that constituted a violation of the separation of powers outlined in the U.S. Constitution, CIA Director John Brennan issued an apology to the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee on July 31st, disclosing that his employees had spied on Intelligence Committee staffers who had been investigating the CIA's role in torture of U.S.-held detainees. Last March, Intelligence Committee Chair Dianne Feinstein of California had accused the CIA of spying on the Senate, charges that Brennan at the time had vehemently denied. The CIA Inspector General issued a report that found 10 CIA staff had improperly accessed or caused access to computers being used in the Senate Committee's investigation of torture. The report further found that CIA security officers involved conducted keyword searches of Senate staffers' emails. The report did not reveal which CIA administrators had ordered the surveillance or when senior staff had been informed of the breach. Bipartisan anger greeted revelations about CIA surveillance of Senate staff, leading two members of the Intelligence Committee to call for CIA Director Brennan's resignation. But President Obama, through his press secretary, stated that the White House still had great confidence in Brennan's leadership. Your reporter spoke with Mel Goodman, director of the National Security Project at the Center for International Policy, who served as an analyst with the CIA for 24 years. Here, Goodman assesses the significance of CIA espionage targeting the Senate and the importance of releasing the Intelligence Committee's 6,200-page report on the agency's role in the torture of U.S.-held detainees during the Bush presidency.
Well, it's extremely important. Not only a violation of law, it's a violation of the Constitution. It's not only a covert action against the Congress, it's a covert operation that was conducted against the very Congressional Oversight Committee that was created in 1976 in the wake of the Church Committee hearings because of CIA violations of law during Vietnam and the COINTEL program and the violations of people's mail and rights and the break-ins at various institutions. So here we have, several decades later, the CIA involved in measures that included secret prisons, erroneous detentions, torture and abuse, renditions and extraordinary renditions, turning people who they pulled off the streets of Europe and the Middle East over to foreign intelligence services, knowing they would be tortured. Foreign intelligence services such as the one in Syria, for example. So in 2009, Senator Dianne Feinstein, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who's been an extremely weak and feckless chairman, did finally ask for documents so they could study the problem of detentions, interrogations, to see if there was indeed torture and abuse. I don't think the CIA wanted to cooperate, so what they did was to overwhelm the committee, at least they thought they would overwhelm the committee, by providing millions and millions of pages of documents and internal reports and field reports that really documented the extensive measures, the torture and abuse that were being undertaken in secret prisons in Eastern Europe, in Southeast Asia, in Afghanistan. And I think at some point, because the CIA had been monitoring this activity, they provided the location for the Senate Intelligence Committee to work in. They wouldn't allow the Intelligence Committee to take this documentation to their offices on the Hill. My guess is they had been monitoring this activity right along and discovered that they turned over documents that they hadn't intended to turn over that really made a strong case about torture and abuse that started before the memos were written at the Department of Justice, and torture and abuse that then went beyond the requirements that were set out by the Justice Department by lawyers such as John Bybee and others. They used assumed identities to break into these computers. They not only broke into the Senate committee files, but they started monitoring emails of staffers. And what the Senate committee had learned was that, yes, this torture and abuse was extensive. It was sadistic. but more importantly, that the White House had been lied to by the CIA, the Congress had been lied to by the CIA, the American people had been lied to by the CIA about whether or not this torture and abuse was really effective. It turns out nothing was really learned that led to any real knowledge, operational knowledge, and there was nothing learned from torture and abuse that couldn't have been picked up with more legitimate schemes of collecting intelligence and eliciting information.
It appears that U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, his response is that no investigation of the CIA will be conducted.
Eric Holder has been extremely weak on all of these national security issues from the very beginning, and particularly with regard to the CIA. The Republicans actually have not been helpful up to now because they didn't even take part in the Senate Intelligence Committee's investigation that produced a 6,000-page report and a 600-page executive summary, which we're now waiting for now that it's been declassified. If John Brennan did not know about this activity, it clearly demonstrates that he's lost control of his agency that he was sent out there to direct. I find it very hard to believe that lawyers of the CIA were involved without the director and the leading officials of the CIA knowing.
What is it that Americans should be demanding in terms of release of this 6,200-page report on U.S. torture in the post-9/11 years? And what action do you think Americans should take on the basis of the law-breaking, both U.S. law and international law, in terms of this horrendously abusive behavior towards many suspects and innocent parties who are caught up in this wave of lawlessness?
Well, at the very least, Americans should be calling the representatives. You know, I talked to a lot of staffers about this, and they claim that one of the reasons why their principals, whether they're senators or representatives, vote the way they do, is they have a free vote in a sense that the constituents rarely call about foreign policy matters. They call about domestic matters and domestic politics, but not about national security and foreign policy, and certainly not about intelligence matters. But they should be calling their congressmen. They should be calling their senators. They should be demanding the release of this report. They should be demanding real change at the Central Intelligence Agency. They should be demanding genuine leadership and not an apparatchik such as John Brennan. This is an institution that needs adult supervision. And until we get a reexamination of the entire architecture of national security, we're going to find out that these crimes are going to be committed within just about every administration. You know, it started with Eisenhower, and I don't think you can cite a president where there wasn't serious law-breaking by the CIA that was endorsed or orchestrated or conceptualized at the National Security Council or at the White House itself. And this is what has to change.
That was Mel Goodman, a former CIA analyst and director of the National Security Project at the Center for International Policy. Goodman's most recent book is titled National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. For more news and commentary on the investigation into CIA torture, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After a bloody month-long conflict between Israel and the Palestinian Hamas government in Gaza, a tenuous 72-hour unconditional ceasefire appeared to be holding after both sides agreed to suspend hostilities on August 5th. Thus far, the conflict has claimed the lives of at least 1,800 Palestinians, mostly civilians, including hundreds of women and children, with over 9,500 injured. Israel reports that 64 of their soldiers have been killed, along with two Israeli civilians and a Thai guest worker. The Israeli government claims its military operation has destroyed 3,000 Hamas rockets and blown up 32 tunnels leading from Gaza to Israel. If the lull in the fighting continues, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas will lead a delegation in Cairo that will include representatives of Hamas and Islamic Jihad to meet with Israeli officials for talks to negotiate the terms of a more permanent truce. Before the ceasefire took hold, an August 3rd Israeli attack on a United Nations-run school where 3,000 Palestinian civilians were taking shelter killed 10 people. The UN says that Israel has attacked 7 of its shelters since the start of the 4-week conflict. In response, the U.S. State Department issued a statement saying that the U.S. was appalled by the disgraceful strike. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon characterized the attack as both a moral outrage and a criminal act, and called for those responsible to be held accountable. The U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation sponsored a Capitol Hill congressional briefing on the violence in Gaza on August 1st, asking the question, is Israel complying with U.S. and international laws? Your reporter spoke with Josh Rubner, National Advocacy Director with the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, who discusses his group's effort to hold the U.S. government accountable for its supply of weapons to Israel in the military assault on Gaza, amid widely reported human rights violations and possible war crimes.
Well, it's quite horrific. More than 1,800 Palestinians killed, at least 377 of them had been children, almost 10,000 people injured, nearly 10,000 housing units deliberately destroyed by Israel. Israel has attacked 160-plus schools and hospitals. Israel has deliberately knocked out Gaza's only power plant, placing 1.8 million Palestinians without access to electricity, without access to clean water. We're starting to see meningitis outbreaks as a result of the collapse of Palestinian civilian infrastructure. And all of these attacks, these deliberate attacks against civilians, against civilian infrastructure, are war crimes. And they are being supported by the United States, both in terms of the weapons that we provide to Israel to attack Palestinians, and the fact that we provide Israel with diplomatic support for these horrific acts. We're demanding that members of Congress and the Obama administration adhere to U.S. law. The Arms Export Control Act is very clear that foreign countries that receive U.S. weapons can only use them for either internal security or legitimate self-defense. Obviously, what Israel is doing right now is not legitimate self-defense. It's instead war crimes and potential crimes against humanity. So all we're asking our members of Congress to do, I mean, we hear all the time that Israel shouldn't be held to a different standard than other countries. And I agree. Israel should be held to the same standards as other countries, according to U.S. law. And that means in the case of the Arms Export Control Act, that when a country violates the terms of the law, that they don't get any more weapons. Plain and simple, that's what the law says. So we were up on Capitol Hill on Friday doing a briefing for members of Congress, which was televised on C-SPAN, which provided some expert and personal testimony from people about Israel's misuse of force against Palestinian civilians, and to demand that Congress adhere to the law. And for those of your listeners who are interested, Congress is now on August recess, and we're organizing delegations to meet with members of Congress to bring this issue to their attention.
What has been the response of House members and members of the U.S. Senate that you've contacted?
Well, overall, it hasn't been great. Congress has passed resolutions in the past month defending Israel's war crimes in Gaza, presenting unsubstantiated evidence that Palestinians are being used as human shields, even though the New York Times found absolutely no evidence of this practice the other day. And just on Friday, before Congress left town, they managed to come up with $225 million in additional weapons for Israel. So on the whole, it's been very negative in terms of what Congress and the administration have been doing. There have been a few bright spots. Representative Keith Ellison from Minnesota is leading the charge for not only an immediate ceasefire, but also for the lifting of Israel's illegal blockade of the Gaza Strip, which is a form of collective punishment, which is considered a war crime, according to Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Conventions.
Do you think as a result of the carnage we've witnessed in Gaza in these past several weeks, that American opinion is changing at all in terms of this blank check written to Israel in any military operation that they want to conduct against the Palestinians?
Oh, absolutely. I think we've seen a number of public opinion polls over the past couple of weeks that have shown that the only majority demographic that supports Israel any longer tends to be old, white, male Republicans. And all other demographics are seeing huge erosions of support for Israel, especially amongst the youth, especially amongst people of color, especially amongst women. So we are seeing huge changes, and I think that these changes in public opinion presage the needed changes that we need to see in the policy level.
That was Josh Rubner, National Advocacy Director with the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. He's author of the book titled Shattered Hopes, The Failure of Obama's Middle East Peace Process. Find more analysis and commentary on the Gaza War and prospects for Middle East peace by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Another horribly botched execution using lethal injection, this one in Arizona, has raised the controversy over the death penalty to a new level. On July 23rd, Joseph Wood III took 2 hours to die after he was injected with 15 times the normal dose of a drug that, in this case, was essentially administered as an experiment on a living human being. After controversy erupted nationwide about Wood's botched execution, Arizona imposed a moratorium on all pending death sentences. 32 states plus the federal government and the U.S. military still employ the death penalty, and lethal injection is the preferred method in all death penalty states. Other methods of execution in use in some states include hanging, electrocution in the gas chamber, and in Utah, firing squad. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Deborah Denno, professor of law at Fordham University School of Law, and an authority on execution methods. She says that due to shortages of lethal drugs used for executions, some banned for export to the U.S. by the European Union, states have been experimenting with different drugs and dosages. Here, Denno reviews some of the history and the ethics of lethal injections used in executions in efforts to improve or end it.
We find ourselves in the position of experimenting with death row inmates in the context of history. I mean, lethal injection was first enacted in this country in 1977. The first lethal injection execution took place in 1982. So we've had this problematic execution method around for decades, and there have been botches and problems for decades. So essentially, Department of Corrections are stuck using drugs that are experimental, that have never been used in the execution process, and that are really not as equipped as the drugs that they used to use.
Didn't states turn to lethal injection because it was supposed to be more humane? Is that the real reason?
That's right. I mean, we have five different methods of execution on the books in the United States, and states started turning to lethal injection because it was supposed to be the most humane. We find that that's not the case. It could be one of the worst methods because of all the problems associated with it. I mean, number one is the original three-drug protocol that was created in 1977 in this country and used exclusively until about 2009, included a paralytic agent that prevented inmates from crying out or moving, essentially. So this sort of peaceful-looking execution process was really part and parcel due to the fact that these inmates were paralyzed and could not cry out. And it was the use of this paralytic agent that really got the Supreme Court to start looking at lethal injections as a constitutional issue in 2008. That said, the most recent executions, many of them aren't involving this paralytic because it's proven problematic. So inmates are able to show distress. You know, it's always been unclear exactly what inmates are experiencing, and you needed an independent review for that. So there are all sorts of different rationales, regardless of whether they're experiencing pain, though. And we, you know, even the experts can't always verify that. You can't interview these people after they die. We do know the execution process lasts 10 times longer than it should. It was 2 hours in this last execution. It should last 10 minutes. That's number one. Number two, inmates should not be physiologically reacting in the way that they are with the, you know, 650 gulps of air and the other kinds of indicators of distress that clearly show that something is going wrong, terrible. horribly wrong. But at the time, there was a possible concern that executions were going to be televised, in which case states wanted an execution method that could look okay on film. And that certainly wasn't electrocution or hanging or even firing squad. So lethal injection came about in part for that reason. But number two, it was felt to be the most humane form.
Deborah Denno, who exactly is administering these lethal drugs? Isn't that another problem, that they're not always the most well-trained individuals?
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the problems with the secrecy is we aren't quite sure who is administrating these drugs. That is kept secret, the execution team. Some states will reveal some of the credentials of these team members, but many states don't. So you don't know where these people are coming from. Sometimes you do find out the qualifications of these people after the fact. For example, we do know that there have been medical doctors involved in even these very highly botched executions out of Clayton Lockett in Oklahoma and Joseph Wood in this latest execution. There was a medical doctor on hand. However, we don't know what kind of role they take. We don't know what kind of credentials they have. I found in some states, the states would take prison volunteers to conduct the execution. In other words, anybody who volunteered. Other executioners were highly untrained. So, you know, there's a lot of variability, but mostly the problem is there's so much secrecy. We don't know who's conducting these executions. In the Joseph Wood execution, for example, his lawyers had requested the credentials of members of the execution team, and those credentials were not provided.
What about legal challenges based on the cruel and unusual punishment element of the Constitution?
The United States Supreme Court has only looked at the constitutionality of any execution method just one time under the Cruel and Unusual Punishment Clause, and that was a lethal injection case that the court took up and decided an opinion on in 2008. And the court said that whatever the state of Kentucky was doing at that time with the three-drug protocol, it was constitutional. Of course, that three-drug protocol really isn't being used much anymore, or really hasn't been used at all because of the lack of sodium thiopental.
In addition to issues around lethal injections, you said other factors that have led to a drop in executions include DNA testing to prove innocence, racial disparities in sentencing and execution, and errors in capital cases.
I mean, all of these factors have snowballed together with the lethal injection problems to suggest to jurors and Department of Corrections and states throughout the country that there are real problems here. And I think it's had an effect.
That was Deborah Denno, Arthur A. McGivney Professor of Law at Fordham University School of Law. Find more information on groups campaigning to end capital punishment in the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.